Welcome to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident, in for Mindy Todd. Today we're going to spend some time talking about a subject that might make some people uncomfortable. Today we're going to talk about whiteness, white privilege, and white supremacy. And this is just one of several conversations we have been having and will continue to have about racism. We're having this discussion today in part because of the protests that have been happening in the streets on the Cape, the islands, and the South Coast, and across the world over the death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police and over systemic racism. Among the calls for change have been calls for white people to stand up and take responsibility for not only benefiting from, but helping to sustain a system that perpetuates racism. And just saying that sentence, I know, is fraught. Talking about race, especially whiteness, is hard. It can make people mad, angry, anxious. White as a race can be hard for some people to even see. But many diversity trainers and anti-racist activists say that understanding whiteness and white privilege is critical in dismantling racist systems. Joining us this morning to help talk about this is Debbie Irving. She's author of Waking Up White and Finding the Story of Race. She's also a racial justice educator. Good morning, Debbie. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning, Katie.
Good morning. Before we get started, I want to set some ground rules. As I just mentioned, talking about whiteness can be difficult, but exploring it can help us learn more about our world. And full disclosure, we are two white women as part of this conversation. And while we will be talking about the concepts of whiteness and white privilege, we don't want to exclude anyone in this conversation. We want to hear from you. But as we explore this topic, I ask that you remain respectful when offering your anecdotes, ideas, or questions. We'll be taking those a little later this hour. But Debbie, first, I want to talk a little bit about you and your story because it will help us to understand some of these really tough concepts. You grew up in Massachusetts, and your childhood was pretty formative in helping you to first think as an adult, but then later on kind of come to terms with what whiteness means for you.
Right. I mean, I think in some ways I had a Norman Rockwell childhood. I remember looking at those images and thinking, wow, I mean, that looks just like my life. Looks like my grandparents' life in Needham, Massachusetts, and my other grandparents in Portland, Maine. And what I understood from Norman Rockwell images, just as an example, was that that was the all-American life. And so you know, how lucky for me that what I was being told was all-American really did look just like my life. And it allowed me to really soak in what I now understand is whiteness, meaning white attitudes, white beliefs, not just, you know, what people look like, but all of the cultural norms that are a part of whiteness.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to try to talk about some of those this hour. There's a lot to talk about, but it took you a long time before you had that kind of aha moment. You know, you felt for a long time, you write about this, that you didn't feel like something was quite right, but you couldn't put your finger on it. But then you had that epiphany in graduate school.
Right. So, I mean, it wasn't until I grew up in White Bubble, Winchester, then I went to White Bubble Kenyon College in Ohio, and I was really not feeling much dissonance at that point. It was when I got out of college and I began working in Boston for organizations like Dance Umbrella and First Night. And part of my job was to create programs, after-school programs for, you could see my fingers, I'm doing air quotes around inner city, underprivileged kids. And for the first time I encountered neighborhoods, and I was really disturbed that there seemed to be an exact correlation between dilapidated buildings and schools with broken windows and textbooks strung together with duct tape, and that correlated with black folks. And then in white neighborhoods, it was the exact opposite. You know, we had lawns and trees and shiny new houses and schools that were being renovated and then renovated again in a few years. And so that, I knew there was something wrong, and yet I had been taught not to talk about race. I was taught to be colorblind. Because we're all humans. We need to just love everybody. Mm-hmm. And so I had grown up around the silence. We didn't talk about race. I had no language. I was terrified of saying something rude or offensive. And so I just let that dissonance kind of rumble around within me. I did start at that point when I did notice that things were wrong. I did start looking for workshops, and I joined diversity committees. And I was on those committees and going to those workshops for 25 years. Thinking that I was sort of a good person.
Mm-hmm. Oh, did we lose you, Debbie?
Whoops. Yeah, my ear just hit the mute button.
Where no problem. No problem. So you were talking about how you've been on these committees for so many years thinking you were a good person.
Right. And then it wasn't, when you say it took me a long time, it wasn't until the age of 48 when I ended up I went back to graduate school to get a degree in special education. I was a teacher at the time. There was a mandatory course. And I think if this had not been mandatory, I think I would still be asleep at the wheel, as I had been until that moment. So the mandatory course was called Racial and Cultural Identities, and I thought I was going to learn about other people's children, black and brown people's children, so I could teach them better. And in fact, on the first day, I was told, we were all told in that class, that we would be doing a deep dive, you know, a 5-month deep dive into our own racial and cultural identity. And to give you and listeners a sense of how naive I was at the time, I didn't even know I had a racial or cultural identity. So I sat there thinking silently, well, what am I going to do for 5 months?
Yeah.
The end of the course, and my whole belief system had begun to unravel.
Yeah. And you say in the book that this, you know, you had a lot of kind of really huge moments in that class, like disturbing moments, and where you'd go home and you'd be up at night. But it really did start you on a journey that's taken years as you've kind of learned and grown and really tried to get your mind around what can feel like for someone who maybe hasn't thought about, well, I'm white, what that means. Can you talk a little bit about what the definition for you for whiteness means? You've already kind of touched a little bit on it.
Yeah. So, and I think it's important to contextualize all of this on the backdrop of the dominant American narrative, which is that the playing field is level.
Mm-hmm.
Is that all we have, this is a very, you know, this is an amazing country. All you have to do is work hard and you can go for the American dream. It's the land of opportunity. So for me to understand that that was not the case, and in fact, all of our laws, policies, customs, practices are embedded in institutions, and all of them favor white people in general, and actually particularly white elite people. So I had no idea about that. I think one of the most shocking things I learned was that the very term white was an invention. You know, the roots of racial categories really go back into Europe, into the 1500s, and the idea in the 1500s, the Enlightenment was that not all people are equal. There's a whole hierarchy of life, and humans are at the top, and in that category, white male humans are at the top. That's an ideology that comes to the shores of what we now call the United States, and yet there was this one really intense moment in the 1600s when the plantation class was losing control, because the masses at that point, the people working on the plantation, they were free blacks, they were indentured white servants, they were a hodgepodge of people. And they started to rise up. The most famous rebellion was Bacon's Rebellion. And as the landed gentry, as the plantation class sought a device to create more control, the device they decided to use was naming a group of, dividing that the masses into in half by calling some of them white people. So that's the very first time the word white is ever used to describe a group of people, is in 1681. And what happens is that group of white people suddenly have rights that the other folks who are all black and brown, you know, if you can't qualify as white, you now are in a new underclass. So white people are now given they're given protection under the law. They are given some rights. And one of the big rights they have is the right to police and patrol black and brown people.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, we've been talking a lot about that as a country in light of what happened a few weeks ago with George Floyd and so many other people in this country. It sounds like, and it's not just looking at it from today's perspective, but it really is kind of going back, if you're really interested in and really understanding your whiteness, to look at history, right? You just talked about the terminology and how it was used in an economic standpoint. But now, you know, 150 years later or so, we've got these kind of lasting impacts, both, of course, economically, but psychologically when it comes to understanding perhaps in our own head as white people, exactly what whiteness might mean to us, right?
Yes, and so, and it's not like we leapt from 1681 to 2020. It's been an unbroken chain mm-hmm. of the creation of laws and policies about who could be white. So, you know, for instance, in 1790, the Naturalization Act was created to determine, you know, who could and could not become a citizen, a naturalized citizen. And in the language of that law was you had to be a free white person of good character. And actually, white can be subjective. Irish were not originally white. Jews were not originally white. Italians were not originally white. They get to become white and get the benefits, the perks that come with being white. And good character, I would suggest, is also a subjective term. Mm-hmm. So that lasts until the 1960s, mm-hmm. which is when, so for all of those years, you had to be white to become a citizen. And a citizen, citizenship is huge. You know, that's about owning property and having voting rights, so, and being protected under the law. So, and then we can come, for every decade, for every year, we could talk about policies that favored white people. The one that really stunned me, I would say people say, well, what was it? What happened in that course? There were a lot of things, and there was one moment, and that was learning about how the GI Bill following World War II functioned as a white-only bill.
Mm-hmm. A form of affirmative action. We think of that as only impacting or benefiting people of color. But in fact, you talk about how this, you know, has done quite a bit generationally, right? Throughout generations to set families up for success. White families.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, $120 billion was transferred from government coffers to veterans returning from World War II. And 98% of that wealth went to white veterans because there were existing barriers all throughout U.S. society that made accessing the bill impossible or very hard for black and brown veterans. So it didn't say it was a white-only bill. It didn't need to because those barriers already existed in our society through programs like redlining or the quota system in education.
You know, this is a lot of information, right? We have to go back in history to understand where we are in the present. But you talk about having that big moment, learning about the GI Bill and knowing that your family had benefited from it. And then you see the other half that didn't, or the other side. How did this make you feel as you were kind of having this epiphany? You had these little moments, but you had this overall kind of awakening, as you say in the title of the book, Waking Up.
I remember that night so well. This course was at night. I was sitting there. We were watching a film, which, by the way, is available online, called Race, the Power of an Illusion. And I heard this line, the 1.2 million black GIs who also fought in World War II were mostly unable to access the GI Bill. And that was a load for me to take in. The first thing I had to contend with was there were black GIs in World War II? You know, where were they in my history books? It never even occurred to me. In my consciousness, every GI in World War II was white. Well, there were also Latinx and Asian and indigenous people fighting for the United States, which I had never known. So that was a lot to take in. And then as I learned that the racist policies were coming from the very highest levels of government, in a way that just impacted people so cruelly. And I understood that my parents didn't even need to know that in order. All they had to do was say, sure, we're going to take advantage of the GI Bill to participate in such an egregious, heinous policy. It just started to break down everything I understood the United States to be. It was not a fair country anymore after 48 years of believing it was. It wasn't the land of the free anymore after 48 years of thinking it was. My family wasn't squeaky clean on the good side of history as I had believed for 48 years. I remember that I had a full-blown asthma attack. I had to leave the class. I had to use my inhaler. And then I spent about 2 months walking around with a bottle of ginger ale because I was so nauseated all of the time. It was grief. I was grieving. I was grieving the country I thought that I was living in as I realized that it doesn't exist yet. And then, of course, you know, as you know from my story, I ultimately made a choice to spend the rest of my life dedicating myself to fight for that country, which is exactly what Black Lives Matter is fighting for, exactly the world that Indigenous people are fighting for, exactly the world that all of our Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities who are engaged in racial justice activism now, mm-hmm. they are the ones fighting for life, liberty, justice for all.
We need to go to a break, but before we do, I want to hear from a caller, Jerry, who called in this week and left us this message as he's been thinking about his own whiteness in light of the conversations we've been having around the country.
Hi, my name's Jerry. I'm a 71-year-old white male Falmouth resident. I grew up, in my case, on Long Island in the 50s in a predominantly white community with all of the baggage of white privilege and of whiteness. I've worked against that much of my life. And I think I've always spoken out in individual circumstances when faced with somebody making a stereotypical or racist statement. I won't say always. I'd say in my adult life, always. I think what's changed now is that I'm coming to recognize that only speaking out in those circumstances is not enough, that it's important. Have you seen injustice that's going on more generally in society to contribute? Whites need to speak out and speak out clearly and forcefully as allies of the Black community. Thanks. Bye.
And my question for you is, are you a white person? Are you realizing the privilege associated with your skin color? Are you educating yourself about institutionalized racism and white privilege? Give us a call. Share your thoughts or your questions with Debbie, 866-999-4626. Or if you want to send us a note, you can email us thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more with Debbie Irving when we come back. You're listening to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident in for Mindy Todd. 866-999-4626. Or you can email us thepoint@capeandislands.org. We are talking about white privilege, white as a racial construct, and white supremacy, and of course racism as well, with author Debbie Irving. We want to hear from you as well. Debbie, talking about race, you know, right before the break, we talked about how painful it was for you to have this realization that the country wasn't exactly what you had grown up to think it was. Whiteness can be really hard to talk about. It's almost taboo. Why do you think it is that way?
Before the civil rights movement, I think people spoke very openly, you know, using all kinds of, you know, racially loaded language. The civil rights movement brought about an idea of colorblindness, and policies were going to be colorblind. Dr. King gave his speech about one day we will, you know, his I Have a Dream speech, one day we will all judge each other by the content of our character and not the color of our skin. And so into the ideology, the greater ideology of the United States, came the idea that, you know, you really couldn't talk about it. We weren't supposed to talk about it. In fact, we weren't even supposed to see it, if that would be possible. And that's exactly how I was raised. And if we don't talk about something, we don't develop any language for it. We don't understand the concepts. We are not talking about the history. And, you know, people of color talk about race every day because you have to for survival. You have to, and you have to teach your children about it. You have to know how to go out in the world and stay safe, how to enter a school that's going to teach you a pack of lies and not speak up and get in trouble. So it's an everyday conversation in households of color. So sometimes I think, you know, one of the ways I think about white people speaking to people of color about race, it's like, you know, 101 meeting PhD. It's just, it's a complete mismatch. There's a really good example of that in a CNN piece today about a young white woman who spoke up saying, how dare you take the Aunt Jemima logo away? She's an example of the American dream. And then you hear a black man who started the petition to remove Aunt Jemima give this, you know, incredibly eloquent history about what Aunt Jemima means. And that, for me, is a perfect example of 101 meets PhD. And I think there's some more loaded elements around this, because the culture of whiteness isn't just about not talking about race. You know, in the last 50 years or so. It's also, it's a culture in which many of us are taught not to rock the boat. If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. And so many, especially white people in the United States, grow up really not developing good conflict navigation skills, which means that if something does go wrong, if I as a white person make a misstep, I may very well lack all of the skills I need to repair that harm,
mm-hmm.
to my way through that conversation, because this is just sort of forbidden territory.
Mm.
And so for people who, white people listening who really want to develop themselves to be able to participate in these conversations, it does become really important to get the skills to navigate conflict and to learn how to repair when we do say something wrong, because we will. You know,
mm-hmm.
I did it last night live, on a public event. So we're really lucky as white people if a person of color thinks enough of us to give us their truth.
Mm-hmm.
So I've learned to consider that a gift and say thank you and apologize and really just do better and better and better every day.
There's so much to talk about, even in what you just said, but I wanted to bring in some callers. We do have some folks on the phone. First, I want to hear from Leisha Fields and Peggy Ilansky, and forgive me if I've mispronounced your names, but you've called in this morning to talk about your own journey and understanding your white privilege. You wrote recently an op-ed in the Cape Cod Times. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having us today.
Thank you. And so you wrote in the Cape Cod Times, this is kind of a big moment for you in understanding kind of your role as an actor in the greater societal picture in looking at race. Tell us some of the things you've been thinking about.
Well, Leisha and I are part of a group of four women who read the book White Fragility this winter and did a lot of work together to kind of unpack our own white privilege. And so in the last month, when all of this came to the forefront again, we just said, we have to share what we've been doing and we have to continue to do the work together.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been part of learning groups. I'm part of two different white discussion groups. There's one really good resource I would recommend for all white folks right now. It's the 21-day Racial Equity Challenge by mm-hmm. Eddie Moore. And it just gives all these questions and examples for us to think about, like moving about our days that we don't have to think about. And so that's very, very helpful. And then we also looked at how we grew up, what our educational background was, what our family composition was, how that all played into our development along the way.
Mm. So similar conversations to what Debbie has been went through and talks about in her book as well. And you mentioned, and I think we've been hearing this kind of in the national conversation from Black people and other people of color saying to white people, do the work. And so to me, it sounds like some of that work is looking at history, as we've been talking about with Debbie, but also some introspection and looking within ourselves. Would you say that to be true, Debbie?
Yes, and thank you for bringing up the 21-day plan. Dr. Moore and I actually created that together. And the reason we created it was because we kept finding that when we did workshops, white people would say, well, tell me what to do. I need to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought it's a little bit like a fitness regimen. Like if you want to get healthy, you don't just go to the gym. You eat better. There are a number of things that you would do. And we started to think about what's the full spectrum of what people need to do to really become racially fit to be a part of this conversation. And so the 21-day plan is a little bit of everything.
Mm.
We have a little list for you to go out and reflect what you're looking at in the world. A little harder to do with COVID, but you can still do it. We've got, you know, podcasts you can listen to, videos you can watch, articles. We have suggestions about who to follow on social media or, you know, get on their mailing list, because books are great. And yet, you know, you can spend a full month with one book. Now you're getting one perspective from one person. What I love about the 21-day plan is that in 21 days, you've heard from a whole spectrum of voices.
Mm-hmm. Are you there, Debbie?
Yep, I did it again.
That's okay. That's all right. No, we're doing the best we can, right?
Yeah.
Keep going.
Yeah. So I'm not sure where you lost me, but the idea is that if you do that 21-day plan, our hope is that on day 22, you don't go, phew, I'm done, or
right.
pat on the back, I'm done. You're just like, give me more. This is amazing.
Right.
And and now you know some new media outlets to connect with. You've gotten introduced to the world of racial justice.
Right. It's really changing your frame of mind in a permanent way. And it's I look at it as like an evolutionary way, because as we've heard and talked about just briefly, that we might make some missteps. And I want to talk about that. But we do have other callers that I'd like to hear from. We have the Reverend Nell Fields from the Wacoit Congregational Church on the line. Thank you so much for calling. Good morning. What's on your mind?
Good morning. Thank you so much for this conversation. It's very important. One of the things that I am concerned about, not only white adults start relearning history, the correct history, but also making sure that we are teaching the correct history in our schools, both our public and private schools, because mm-hmm. This is going to take a long time to change, a long, long time, and it's got to be something that is happening at all levels of society,
mm-hmm.
not just the privileged, educated white people, but all segments of society. And I'm kind of curious as to what would Debbie's reaction be to that as a former teacher?
Debbie?
Yeah. Thank you for that. It's such an obvious point. Of course we need to teach a truer history if we want to understand the country we live in, the world we live in. And a lot of the work I do these days, about, I would say, 50% of the organizations I engage with are schools. And so I have a front row seat to what the problems are there with trying to change it. And the problem is, you know, there's this great book called You Can't Teach What You Don't Know. And so it becomes very hard. 85% of teachers in the United States are white, raised in this colorblind era. The vast majority are not what I would call racially literate, culturally competent. They don't speak this language. They don't know it. And so you could hand a curriculum that teaches a broader history, and yet the teacher isn't prepared. This is new for the teacher. The information is new for the teacher. The kind of conversations that it's going to open up are going to be emotional, very likely. And does the teacher have the skills to handle and navigate that kind of conversation, particularly in classrooms where it may be racially mixed? Because some of these kids of color may very well be coming from homes where they have known this history forever and are racially literate and culturally competent. And the other big obstacle that we see, and it's not that these aren't things that can be remedied, it's just these are sort of the barriers that we have to work through to be able to teach what I would like to see be teach and the caller would like to see be teach taught. The parents often... The most powerful parents in any given town or any given school, if we're talking about private schools, the most powerful group of parents want to shut it down. This is not what I sent my child here to learn. I want them reading Shakespeare, and they'll list a bunch of, you know, sort of dead white men scholars. And again, now the parents aren't prepared for the kind of conversations that their children are going to bring home. So it has to be a holistic approach. Parents need to be onboarded. Teachers need to be onboarded, administrators, superintendents, everybody, school committees need to be onboarded about why this history is so important and what the challenges are when we start to tell a different story than it's been taught for 400 years.
Hmm. And I would like to add, too, that this is a huge topic, as you just kind of highlighted for us. And we want to have a discussion more deeply about education coming up in the future for kids in the like school systems as well. And so we want to think more deeply about that. But I think another thing that this topic highlights is that these problems are systemic. And we've been hearing that a lot, again, in the national conversation over the last month or so, that we need to not just confront individual acts of racism, but we need to confront systemic racism. And Debbie, I want to have you help us define that a little bit better. You go through great detail to help in your book put language behind an expanded definition of racism. Reverend Fields, thank you so much for your call, by the way. I appreciate that. But Debbie, can you talk a little bit about how we might want to think about racism beyond just one single act or even a grouping of acts of hatred into a bigger picture?
Yeah, so prejudice, I like to start thinking about what prejudice is. Prejudice or bias, those are interchangeable for me. That means prejudging somebody based on some prior experience, prior information, you know, what we hear in the ether here in the United States. So anybody, any person, any group of people can prejudge another person or another group of people. That truly is a level playing field. Where it becomes an ism, racism, homophobism, sexism, classism, where it becomes systemic is when one group has the power to embed that bias, that prejudice into laws, into policies, into your corporate culture, your school culture. And so that's where it becomes systemic. I think one of the most powerful examples is redlining. So in the 1920s, there was a Great Depression. 1930s comes along. FDR has the New Deal. The New Deal is an economic stimulus package. We're going to create all this new housing out in suburbs, and we're going to have highways built in order to bring people from cities back and forth, cities to suburbs. Well, how are people going to afford these new homes? Along comes the mortgage. That becomes a part of the New Deal package, and the FHA is formed, Savings and Loan Arm is formed, and now they have to figure out how are we going to manage our risk around these mortgages. And there are two criteria. One is the condition of the building. The other one is the skin color of the residents living around that house. So so cities all over the country lay out maps and they start color coding their cities based on the racial identity of who lives there. And so in neighborhoods where black folks live, those get redlined. That's why the practice is called redlined. And mortgages are not going to be given out there. It's too risky. Hazardous is the lending language applied to that. Whereas in an all-white neighborhood, the interest rate is super low. And so this is systemic racism. So when the GI Bill comes along and it's welcome home, boys, here's a zero money down, low rate mortgage to go buy your home. That was one of the benefits in the GI Bill. It's only good in white neighborhoods. And that is why black and brown GIs are cut out of the GI Bill housing component.
Mm-hmm. I have an email here from Jenny who says, and she was thinking about missteps that she takes as she's on her trying to learn more about her own whiteness. And she says, if I have a misstep with black people or a person of color and it's pointed out to me, I apologize. I do not challenge them or ask them to educate me, even if I don't understand. I know in these times there are plenty of resources to search out and find more as to why I may have been blind to what just happened. And of course, we've already talked about the 21-day program that you mentioned. And it's true. It's like a quick keystroke away. It's a Google away to find just tons and tons of literature written both recently in the past hours, days, weeks, but also throughout the decades as people of color have been trying to point this out for many, many years. I want to go quickly to a break. Hold that thought. We do have some folks on the line. Please hang on. We want to hear from you. And if you're thinking about whiteness, white privilege, what racism means, and you want to join in the conversation, give us a call, 866-999-4626, or email us, thepoint@capeandislands.org. You're listening to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident in for Mindy Todd. And today we're talking about whiteness, white privilege, and racism. And we want to hear from you. 866-999-4626. Or you can send us a note to thepoint@capeandislands.org. We have the Reverend Kate Epperly on the line. She's been on the line for a few minutes, chair of the Barnstable No Place for Hate group. And Reverend, I hear that you've done this 21-day challenge that we were just talking about before the break.
Yes, and thank you, Debbie, so much for your program. It's high impact for sure. But what made it even higher impact was that we were right in the middle of it when George Floyd was killed. And it kind of blew the whole program out of the water. In fact, we had all just finished watching Facing History and Ourselves, the three-episode documentary that you were talking about. And the context is not local, and so I want to go local because I want to respond to what Reverend Nell Fields mentioned and kind of what where we are on the Cape with this, and again, using your resources. I'm not the chair, by the way. I'm on the steering committee. Eileen Elias is the chair.
My apologies for that. Yeah.
Yes, that's okay. But we are beginning to research and talk with the schools, and there has been movement that there is interest in training. We are looking at the program of Facing History and Ourselves. I'm sorry, the other series was the Power of the Illusion. That was the, mm-hmm. the three-episode series. I misspoke. But looking at Facing History and Ourselves or Piggy McIntosh's seed program for training faculty and getting curriculum about these issues into the schools. And with the climate in the last couple months, I'm optimistic that change can occur here on the Cape. We did have a white privilege program with Eddie Moore, and I just want to commend, I know that you, Deb, work with him and Peggy in the Privilege Institute. Just commend that to everybody. Again, another wonderful, solid resource. We had 200 people here on the Cape. This was about 3 years ago, thanks to Barbara Burgo and the Human Rights mm-hmm. Commission. And we will be doing that again, I just want to assure you. But we are on the topic, and again, I'm just very grateful. But what I'm interested in is how I can pick up the pieces from the 21-day racial equity program, which kind of got blown apart here, and everyone was too overwhelmed to talk about things. If you have any thoughts, Deb.
You know, thank you for that, and thanks for using all these resources. Barbara Burgo, I think, is a Cape Cod heroine and should be celebrated as such for the activism that she just brings again and again to your area. You know, the 21-day plan is a plan that people can do again and again. There's actually one national organization who does it annually every year as sort of a tune-up. And, you know, we have been so busy, given the current times, that the plan that we offer is sort of a general how to understand whiteness. One suggestion I would have for you would be, what would it be like to recreate a new plan full of COVID intersecting with race, full of policing, defunding policing? And so create your own 21-day plan full of really up-to-date resources. And in fact, you know, what could be, and also some local, you know, include articles that have to do specifically with the Cape. And I would also suggest broaden it beyond black and white. You know, you've got a very rich indigenous history there to understand, the Nauset people and the greater, you know, here we are living in Massachusetts. I say that word all the time. That's an indigenous term, you know, mm-hmm. the Massachusetts people. So when we offered the 21-day plan, we fully expected that people would be able to trade out our resources for newer resources or resources more specific to your area or your sector. So I would say play with it. And I actually think that the process of creating the plan is actually a growing process too, because now you've got people, you can pull more people into that developing the plan process. You can promote it more broadly. You can pull more people into it. So if you go onto my website, you can see various versions of the plan that people have done. We also have a 21-day website, Facebook page, where you can interact with other people across the country using the plan, and you can share ideas that way. So it is a tool that's as flexible as you want to make it. And I hope you'll do that, and I hope you'll share what you come up with us so we can all learn from you.
Thank you for that. And thank you, Reverend, for your call. I appreciate it. And, keep in touch as to what you do and talk about in the coming weeks and months, because we want to keep this conversation going on WCAI as well. We have Dale on the phone from Bourndale. Good morning, Dale. Thank you for calling in.
Morning. I got my speakerphone on. Maybe that's why the echo.
I think so. If you could put the phone up to your ear, we'll be able to hear you better and understand your question or your comment.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I can give you the prime example of systemic bias. 7 years ago, I had a surgical procedure. And right before the procedure, the doctor approached and described to me what she's going to do, how long it takes, how many they do a day. All I could smell was alcohol. I had intravenous in one arm of fluids. I had intravenous of anesthesia in the other. I raised up. I yelled, "Somebody give me a pen and a piece of paper. Someone give me a pen and a piece of paper." The doctor gave me a pen. The anesthesiologist gave me a piece of paper. I wrote down on the paper, "Is the doctor drunk?" I gave it to the anesthesiologist. He said no. Okay, he gave the paper back. I balled it up, threw it in the garbage. I went through the procedure. And he told me my wife was waiting outside. I got outside. My wife said, "How did it go?" I said, "I think that doctor was drunk." I got home. I was still a little groggy. The phone rang. My son answered it. I got the phone, and I was thinking that, oh, yeah, they were going to call to see how I am. And I got the phone. It was the head surgeon of the hospital. And he said, "Mr. McDowell, you wrote a note asking was the doctor intoxicated?" I said, "Yes, I did." He said, "Well, it got back to me." He said, "I went down to observe this doctor for myself doing the second procedure. I felt it necessary to pull that doctor out of that procedure. And I looked that doctor in the eye and I asked the doctor, have you been drinking?" The doctor said, "No." He said, "Well, I'm going to test you right now." He said he took the doctor down. He said that, "Mr. McDowell, you were right. The doctor was intoxicated." My life has been a nightmare since. But besides that, the events that took place after that, anyway, he says that I have to have the procedure done all over again. And they were going to set it up, and they were going to take care of this, and they were going to take care of that. Well, unbeknownst to me, the company that I was working for, the owner of the company, sits on the board of trustees of that hospital.
Dale, this sounds like a very traumatic story, and so grateful that you made it through that surgery. And thank you for sharing this. This is a tough story to listen to. And Debbie, it reminds me of when we're talking about implicit bias and whiteness, how difficult I think it can be for many white people to hear, as Dale is talking about, to hear when somebody says something is wrong, when a person of color tries to recount an event where he or she may have felt discriminated against, or that the interaction was racist.
Right. And I just hear so much racism in that story. So imagine a white man had been there and had asked to write that note. I'm pretty sure that note would have been taken more seriously.
Yeah.
And then I also think about a physician coming in drunk. The chances of a white man thinking that he can come in drunk or to fly a plane or drive a train or run an organization or perform surgery, there is so much margin of error for white men in this country that they get away with a lot. A black or brown indigenous physician, male or female, would very likely never try to do anything drunk because the margin of error is zero.
Right. Stakes are too high. Yeah.
Stakes are too high. And so that's how, you know, someone could hear that story and say, well, that's one bad moment. No, I actually think that there's a lot in that story. And I thank you so much for sharing it. It does sound terribly traumatic. And I also hear that it's ongoing. So,
yes, Dale. Ouch. Yes. We wish you the best. And we'll be thinking of you. And thank you for sharing. It's a painful story. And I think it highlights, too, the importance of listening when we can and trying not to judge as white people listening to stories that if we think we're good people and we don't necessarily want to confront that maybe we have bias and racist thoughts, can be very uncomfortable.
Can be very uncomfortable. And I think, you know, if I had been listening to this 12 years ago before I started waking up, because I had been taught that black, indigenous, and any person of color wasn't trustworthy. I mean, I didn't know I'd been taught that, but deep in my subconsciousness, that lurked there. I would have heard that story, and my first thought would have been to question it.
Mm. Right, listening, yeah.
I would have listened, but I would have questioned. And so it becomes important to say, why am I questioning? Why don't I believe this? That isn't about the person that's telling you the story. That's about you. That's your whiteness.
We have another caller that I want to get to. We just have a few minutes left. Father Ken Campbell from Orleans, president of the Nauset Interfaith Association. Good morning. Thank you for calling in and for holding on.
Good morning, and thank you for this hour. It's been excellent. And I'll be quick and to the point. The Nauset Interfaith Association covers the Lower Nauta Cape, although we also work with Falmouth and Barnstable. We have just want to mention some of the things going on that some of our listeners might be interested in. We have a Martin Luther King Action Team is one of our four action teams, which has been working in this whole area of racism and white privilege for a number of years. We have groups studying the letter from the Birmingham jail from Dr. King. And also we are planning a service of commemoration, not celebration, with the indigenous Wampanoag tribe on December the 8th. We did it last year, and we're going to do it again for the 400th year anniversary. And some folks might be interested in that, in which we will together officiate at that really a lamentation at dawn. Let people be know, because that's when it happened 400 years ago, December, at First Encounter Beach in Eastham. And also I want to mention a couple of others. We have, last year we took 60 people, we made a pilgrimage to the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things, and we're going to hopefully do that again this fall coming, is the, as long as the COVID-19 is set aside, is the importance of white people to have understanding of black history and culture.
That's right. Father, thank you. I don't mean to cut you off, and we'll try to get some more details on the events that you're helping to host to help people learn this history and understand racism, bias, and privilege. And Debbie, this hour went by too fast. Thank you for helping us, guiding us through this conversation, finding some language, and maybe doing some introspection. That's Debbie Irving, author of Waking Up White and a racial justice educator. Again, this is just one of what we hope become a series of conversations. So keep thinking about this, and we want to hear from you along the way. We'll have more information about Debbie's book and the 21-day program and other resources if you don't want to Google yourself, but you certainly can, and I hope you do. I'm Catherine Ident, in for Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.